It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as we've been hearing the past few weeks, meatpacking plants across the country have become coronavirus hotspots. Thousands of workers infected, leading to closures, disrupting the nation's food supply chain. So much so that President Trump signed an executive order that said meat processing plants are a part of the nation's critical infrastructure. He declared that a while back. Well, this week here in Iowa, state health officials reported that more than 1,600 workers at four Iowa meatpacking plants have been infected with the coronavirus. Let's get an update from IPR's Kate Payne, who's been covering aspects of this story in Iowa for Iowa Public Radio and for NPR. Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. So tell us about the latest developments this week. This Tyson plant that in Waterloo that you've been reporting on, did it in fact resume operations yesterday, Thursday?
Yes, it did. So restarted operations. And one thing that we saw yesterday as well, actually, is that local health officials in Blackhawk County confirmed even more workers having tested positive than was initially stated by state health officials. So Blackhawk County Public Health said yesterday that 1,031 Tyson employees had tested positive there in Waterloo, compared to 444 that the state had said. And so apparently the county health officials are including even more testing that was done by local healthcare providers and serological testing, looking at more tests than the state was looking at in their number. But all that to say, a lot of employees there have tested positive.
Right. And among the, I was looking in the New York Times this week at a chart among the 10 metropolitan areas with the most new confirmed virus cases per capita, half are home to meat processing plants. And on that chart of top 10 metro areas with the most new confirmed virus cases per capita, Waterloo Cedar Falls on that list, Sioux City number one. So this is really a focus point for the nation in terms of this coronavirus. Let's talk a little bit about the people who work meatpacking. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we have a higher percentage of foreign-born workers in meatpacking than any other field. Describe how much meatpacking depends on immigrant workers. And you've spoken with some of them in the Waterloo area.
Yeah, so meatpacking plants in Iowa and across the Midwest have been real opportunities for immigrants, for refugees, for a long time to come to the United States and to get a steady job, you know, better than minimum wage, maybe $15, $20, $25 an hour. And folks are really able to make a life for themselves and their families. So at the Waterloo plant in particular, you know, there are folks from Bosnia and Burma, the Marshall Islands, Liberia, Congo, as well as people from Latin America, and also islands who have felony convictions have also been able to get jobs at these facilities too. So there are a lot of languages being spoken in these facilities, a lot of people coming from different life perspectives. Mm-hmm. So it's a real challenge for people just to get basic information. And so I was speaking with some workers who are refugees, and they were saying that, you know, just they're getting virtually no communication from Tyson leadership, and we're having to rely on other workers to pass along information about, you know, what safety updates had been made about, you know, has somebody tested positive? So really relying on trickle-down information.
Right. And you know, immigrant workers in this country have the same rights as those of us who are native-born to the United States. But as you described in your piece, in your reporting, there are these, which you've just touched on, language, cultural barriers. Those of us who have lived somewhere else in a different culture, in a different language, I count myself in that number. You really don't understand the hurdles, the barriers you have to participating in the culture, in work, and until you experience that. But that's what these people are looking at in this crisis.
Yeah, and that's what I'm hearing from advocates is understandably, you know, if you have If English is not your primary language, if that is a barrier, and if you just don't have a good level of comfortability with the law and the process, folks are much more hesitant to go through that process and to exercise their rights, whether that's, you know, working in the plant or whether that's, you know, turning to state agencies and filing for workers' compensation or some of the other supports that are out there. And I spoke with a civil rights lawyer in Waterloo who said that he is hearing from Tyson workers who have complaints and, you know, maybe there are legal claims there, but he said he's not hearing from refugees in particular. And he, for one, is concerned that these immigrant communities will not get the legal support that really maybe they need in this time.
All right. Kate, before we say goodbye in just a few seconds, give us a look forward to your reporting on this.
So we're really just going to be keeping tabs on what happens with these cases. You know, Tyson has said, and local leaders have acknowledged that they've made changes at this plant in Waterloo and installing plastic protectors around workstations, providing more personal protective equipment, making more coronavirus testing available. But we know, you know, nearly 3,000 workers are employed at that plant. You have a tremendous amount of people in close proximity working for hours at a time. We know that plants across the country are prone to this virus. So as workers start going back, we have to keep tabs on, do these numbers go up again?
Okay. Kate Payne, we can't thank you enough for this tremendously important work you're doing reporting. Eastern Iowa reporter Kate Payne, we'll look forward to your further reports.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's continue our series of conversations with a variety of Iowans over time, tracking different types of individuals in our state, tracking them through this crisis, to see how their thoughts, their lives and plans, their hopes and fears change over the coming months. Well, today we get to know Tasha Rhodes. Tasha lives now in Mount Pleasant. She's originally from Ottumwa and joins us now. Hi, Tasha.
Hello.
I wonder if you could start by briefly introducing yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, when I was born, I weighed 1 pound and 6 ounces. And then I lost 5 ounces at birth. I was born 4 months early. And I was born in Ottumwa, and then they took me to Iowa City, where I remained in the INCU thing for, I think, about 3 or 4 months. And my blindness happened because back almost 42 years ago now, they didn't have the oxygen monitors to, you know, let doctors know how much I was receiving. So they had to put me on 100% oxygen so I could survive. And so that's what caused my blindness. A lot of people, the old term was ROP, retinopathy of prematurity, but now I believe it's called RLF, retinal fibroplasia or something. I don't remember, but a lot of my friends that are blind, that's a lot of how that happened to them too, but especially for me, that's what happened. And I mean, I have a great family. My parents are awesome. All my family is just incredible, very supportive of me and everything.
So let me ask you also to just find a little more out about you. So how do you spend your time? What gives you joy in life? How do you spend your days?
I'll be honest with you. I'm on the phone too much. I'm a gossip. I'm a gabby person, and sometimes, a lot of times, that can get me in trouble. So I'm trying. I just moved on my own last Saturday, so I'm trying not to burn too many bridges.
So you just moved out from some kind of home where you had people who helped you out to now you're completely on your own in Mount Pleasant?
No, they still help me every day, including the weekends, for about 4 hours. However, I was living with two ladies, and now I'm on my own in my own apartment. But no, I get a lot of help still.
Mm-hmm. I understand that religion is also a big part of your life. Tell us about that.
Yes. I've known Jesus from a very young age. Age 2.5 or so, 2 to 3 years old, from what I was told growing up, that my mom was taking piano lessons from a church person, a lady, and I would sit up there next to her and kind of plink on the keys. And, you know, one moment she was listening to it, and she's like, oh, my gosh, she's playing the same keys I am. And I, like I said, I was only about 2 or 3 years old, couldn't even read music, for goodness sakes.
Uh-huh.
And so basically since then, she kind of stopped taking lessons that let me take over the piano, and I also play the flute. As well, and I've written a couple songs. I love to sing. It's just part of who I am. I always have been. Started singing when I was 4 years old, and playing the flute when I went to the Braille school. We can get into that another day, but that, I started at that age 9, so 9 years old.
So let's talk about the changes that you have. A big change. You moved to a new place after living with 2 other people for years. Let's talk specifically about this pandemic sweeping across the country mid-March or so. How would you say your life has been changed by what's happened and changed all of our lives?
Yeah, it's definitely changed all our lives, especially for me, too, because, like you were saying, I just moved, and that's been a big enough change in itself. But, and I won't say the company's name, but my staff from that company, we can't really go anywhere except maybe, you know, to Walmart, like pick up stuff online, you know, have it put in the cars. But, you know, we can't just go on the bus or, you know, right away until the state opens up totally. So it's been kind of boring, quite frankly.
Okay. I'm sure your sentiments are echoed by any number of people listening right now.
Even if they're not blind, I'm sure they could relate somehow.
Yes, that's exactly.
They're bored, or they're bored, or something.
That's exactly what I mean. What, Tasha, are your biggest concerns right now in your life? Are they tied to the pandemic?
You know, not really. I guess one of my big concerns is, like I said, I'm trying to. I mean, I guess it is in a way. I get bored, and so I just text people or talk to them all the time. So I used to be on a phone restriction where I could only call a certain amount of people with, like, so much a day, and I don't want to be put back on that. So I'm trying to, like I said, balance out how much I talk on the phone or text, and, you know, just try to do other things. And I don't have cable right now either, so.
I wanted to ask you in closing here a little bit about back to your musical life and how so early in your life you were able to the astonishment of your family, pick out tunes on a piano, and you've written songs that you actually sing. May I put you on the spot and ask you to share something you've written?
Sure, I have 2 songs that kind of go together, and I can sing those if you want.
Oh, we'd love it.
When you're faced with a situation where your hope seems at an end, you can lean on the Lord Jesus. He's your ever faithful friend. He said, I will strengthen you and uphold you with my righteous right hand. If you love me, then obey my commands. I'm Jehovah Jireh, who will meet your every need.
Well, I want to thank you for this conversation, and I hope we'll be able to talk to you in some time. As part of this series, we're tracing people over time through this crisis, and we've got a good starting point with you to learn about your life, and we'll check back in at some point and find out how things have progressed, Tasha. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you feel your heart is heavy? Are you swimming in despair? God says, when you call my name, then I will be right there.
Tasha Rhodes lives in Mount Pleasant and shared a bit of her life with us today, as well as her music, original music.
Because if you let him, he will free you from your strife.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, remember back on May 1st, that was just a week ago, restrictions were relaxed in 77 of Iowa's 99 counties. The counties not hit as hard by the coronavirus. As of today, a week later, May 8th, Governor Kim Reynolds has eased a few more restrictions. Let's find out about it from Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief with Lee Enterprises. Hi, Aaron.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, thank you for being with us for the next 5 minutes or so. What restrictions have been loosened up as of today?
So as you noted, the process began with the original declaration that opened up a lot of businesses in 77 of the state's 99 counties where the virus has not been as widespread thus far. And then the new order relaxed a little bit more of that and also added some openings in the 22 counties where the virus has been more prevalent, areas that have been harder hit. A lot of retail type stores and malls can and open up. Oh, they have to stay at no more than 50% capacity, but starting today, malls and retail stores can open in those 22 counties as well. So we are very much underway now in this phased-in approach the governor has taken into reopening businesses across the state.
Right, and I see more latitude for dentists. Dentists have been suffering
a lot.
Yeah.
Yep. Campgrounds, drive-in movie theaters included in that. Yep.
Now, is that in all counties or just in the counties that have not been hard hit?
The dentist was the dentist and drive-in theaters were in all counties.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. The malls and retail stores was a new one specific because they had already been okayed in the 77 counties and they were added to the newest one.
Right. And as you noted in your reporting, I see that it's notable that in the 22 counties hardest hit in our state, restaurants are still not able to open.
Yes, that is correct. Restaurants are still excluded. So when I say retail, we're talking clothing stores, furniture stores, those kinds of things. Restaurants in the 22 counties still have to operate under the original order, which is they can stay open for drive-through or carry-out, but they can't open their dining areas.
Right. And some of these 22 counties that are still affected by the restrictions, though loosened a little bit, still quite a few restrictions, are some of our big population centers, the Blackhawk County, Lynn, Johnson, Scott, Washington County, Woodbury County there in the northwest, Polk, of course, in the central part of the state. The governor issued these further loosening of restrictions on Wednesday. What was the rationale the governor gave for this?
Well, part of it is the governor and her public health department say that they are looking at the data and information that they're seeing about the way that the virus is spreading and that that they believe they're in a place where it's safe to do this, especially as it relates to not overburdening our hospital system. And so that's something they continue to point to, that the point of the mitigation strategies was to make sure that we don't overburden hospitals with sick people. So they believe that we are in a place now where hospitals could handle more cases if that were to happen. And that especially in those 77 counties, but even with the somewhat reopening in the 22 counties, the governor makes the point that the goal was never to necessarily eliminate the virus. It's going to be around. It's about managing and containing it. And they feel that that they can do that at this point with those relaxed restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Vice President Pence visiting Iowa today. The Governor Reynolds, she flew to Washington this week. What can you tell us about that visit? What do we know about it?
Yeah, she had a meeting with I know President Trump, Vice President Pence, and Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue were all there. Governor Reynolds said she relayed kind of what we've been talking about, what her strategy has been, what they've done in Iowa to start reopening businesses. She talked about the expanded testing that's taking place in Iowa, with more people getting tested now than before. And they also spent a good deal of time. The governor talked about this, and reporters who were in the room covering it noted that they spent a good deal of time talking about the outbreaks at the food processing plants and the different things that the plants themselves and the state, different steps they're taking to manage that and avoid that from occurring again.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you reported on this a few days ago, some new polling out. Elaborate on this. Fill us in on some more specifics. More than half of Iowans approve of the job that Governor Reynolds is doing, but that's contrasted a bit with the approval rating that the president gets.
Yeah, that was very interesting. And it to some degree, it might be that political scientists will tell you that there's people always feel a little bit closer to a little bit better about the elected official that's closest to them. So mayors, when you talk about favorability ratings and approval numbers, mayors tend to do a little bit better than governors, who tend to do a little bit better than presidents. So there might be a little bit of that going on there. But you're right, and that was interesting to see in that data in the polling, and they had conducted this across the entire country. So these numbers were broken down for every state. That when they asked, do you approve of the job your governor is doing in handling this pandemic, 54% in Iowa said that they approve of the job Governor Reynolds is doing. Now, this was before some of these steps that have been taken to reopen businesses. That's mm-hmm. been controversial. Some people are nervous about that. So it would be interesting to see if we get new polling since those actions have been taken place, to see whether that has moved that needle, whether people still have confidence in the governor with those steps taken. But 54% and President Trump's approval meantime was, I believe, 46% was the number. So it was interesting to see how Iowans felt better about Governor Reynolds handling at the state level than the president handling at the federal level.
Aaron Murphy, thanks for the update. Des Moines Bureau Chief with Lee Enterprises. Always great to have you on the program, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Always great to do it. Thanks again, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, well, for Democrats, flipping the Senate seat held by Republican Joni Ernst will likely be an uphill battle. I'll talk with Clay Masters in just a moment about the candidates vying to face Ernst in the general election. Also, can poetry help us deal with this pandemic? We'll find out after the break. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, remember 6 years ago? I can barely remember 6 months ago with all this upheaval. But let's go back 6 years. Joni Ernst's victory 6 years ago in 2014 gave Iowa a pair of Republican U.S. senators for the first time since the mid-1980s. Now, this year, for Democrats, flipping that U.S. Senate seat held by Ernst is likely to be an uphill battle. Let's learn about the primary candidates vying to face Ernst in the general election. The primary election is June 2nd. Clay Masters joins me, IPR Morning Edition host, of course, and political reporter. Hi, Clay.
Hey, Ben.
I want to go to have you sort of do a little bio on each of these Democratic candidates. But before that, set the scene for us as Joni Ernst faces her very first reelection bid.
Yeah, you were talking about 2014. That was when Joni Ernst defeated Bruce Braley, the former congressman from Iowa's 1st Congressional District. Bruce Braley early on was seen as the Democrat who could take over for retiring Democratic Senator of Iowa, Tom Harkin, you know, served for many, many years here in Iowa. But Joni Ernst won, and like you said, took over and Iowa became a state with two U.S. senators who are Republicans. And now, as we look at 2020, there is a poll out that came out this week that showed, from the public policy polling, that the race is tightening here among whoever the Democratic candidate is going to be and Joni Ernst. Now, there are questions about any poll because they just represent a snapshot in time, mm-hmm. but we are seeing more interest from the national level in Iowa in trying to pick up this Senate seat for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, I see in the news that Joni Ernst, as well as Senator Grassley, meeting with the vice president during his visit today in Iowa.
Yeah, certainly the Republican U.S. senators are wanting to, you know, welcome the vice president to the state, and they're continuing to want to be in good graces with the Trump administration. You know, Donald Trump won Iowa 4 years ago, and Joni Ernst is going to be on that ticket with Donald Trump this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to the candidates. There are now four Democrats, used to be five, one dropped out. Four Democrats officially running at this point in the primary race that will decide which candidate challenges Joni Ernst in the November general election, that primary to be held June 2nd. There's early voting by mail going on. Next week, we'll start airing a series on Iowa Public Radio that you've done with interviews with these Democratic primary candidates, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
So let's have you introduce us to each of them quickly.
So yeah, I've talked with three of the four Democrats who are running. We'll run through it. Mike Franken, he's most notably a retired three-star admiral who served for 37 years in the U.S. Navy. He has a background in education and engineering and physics degrees. He was on Senator Ted Kennedy's staff and worked for the Department of Defense. He's originally from Lebanon, which is this small, Lebanon, Iowa, this small northwest Iowa town. And I did ask him, what do you say to the critics who would say that you're just moving back to Iowa to run for Senate? And he says, you know, it's not like I can go back to where I spent most of my life on a ship or in Washington, D.C. and run for, right. and run for office. Then we've got Kimberly Graham, who is an attorney who represents abused and neglected children. She lived in Indianola for a lot of years, and now she's in Des Moines. She actually said she started thinking about running for office after the 2016 election and signed up for the Ready to Run boot camp at Iowa State University, the Chapman Kant Center. She did that in 2017, and she's been in this race now for a year. Teresa Greenfield, she's another candidate, also from Des Moines. Now, she has led the Iowa division of Rotland Homes and served as president of Colby Interests, which is a Des Moines real estate and development company. People might remember the Greenfield name because of her 2018 run when she was running for the 3rd Congressional District. Now, there was alleged paperwork forgery that forced her to do this mad dash to resubmit her candidacy at the last minute. You might remember that prevented her from making it on the ballot. She's the only candidate that I haven't talked to yet for these profiles next week. And then Eddie Morrow, a small business owner based in Des Moines. He likes to highlight that he was once a teacher and a coach, and his name might sound familiar as well because he also, like Greenfield, ran in 2018 for the 3rd Congressional District race. That, of course, went to Cindy Axne, who now represents that district in the House. And then finally, I should note, too, we mentioned that somebody dropped out, Cal Woods. He is still on the ballot, so there will be five names, but he dropped out and actually endorsed Mike Franken earlier this week.
Mm-hmm. I've been seeing polls here. Joni Ernst matched up. I don't know if these are polls, Democratic polls, or what kind of polls matched up against Teresa Greenfield. When you talked about the field tightening, is she considered a front runner at this point?
Yeah, the way that the race is looking at this point, I mean, if you're basing it on fundraising and endorsements, Teresa Greenfield is the front runner. I mean, she's been endorsed both nationally and locally here in Iowa. Notably in the state, Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer has endorsed her. Also, retiring Congressman Dave Loebsack has endorsed Teresa Greenfield. One note here, within the last 24 hours, the Des Moines Register's editorial board, of course, the largest newspaper in the state, it announced that the ed board is backing Mike Franken. Also, going back to Teresa Greenfield, there is a super PAC that's been spending a lot of money backing her challenge to Ernst. You might have seen these ads that are kind of introducing her. And this is something that all of her competitors kind of mentioned during these interviews, that they're concerned that there's already somebody been chosen. And especially Eddie Morrow has been, he came out with an ad this week attacking Greenfield.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk in the final minute or so about how this election will be different. It will, as everything in life, this primary election, and who knows, in November, we'll see. Talk about how campaigning is different.
Well, the campaigning certainly is different because all the candidates are talking how they're having to shift to doing all their campaign work online through video conferencing and sending out social media messages. On the election itself, I think it's important to note that to vote in the primary, you must be registered as a Democrat or a Republican, and you can do this by checking your party's box on your absentee ballot request form. Many of these made it into mailboxes last week, and the Secretary of State is encouraging people to vote by mail. There will also be a number of changes to the way that Election Day works. There will be curbside voting. There will be fewer polling places to reduce the risk of people, you know, contracting coronavirus. There will be more hand sanitizer. Pollsters or poll workers will be wearing face masks. So there is a lot of encouragement for people to vote by mail, but there will still be polls open on June 2nd, and it doesn't seem to be at this point any indication that June 2nd won't go off as an election here in the state.
All right, Clay Masters with that preview of the primary candidates vying to face Joni Ernst in her first re-election bid in November, of course. And Clay, we'll be airing your interviews with these candidates next week during Morning Edition?
That's correct.
Okay, Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. Thanks for popping in.
Yeah, you're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we finish up the hour, Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio Studio One just ahead to groove us into the weekend. But before that, you know, we're all dealing with this crisis in our own ways, dealing with the anxiety over contracting the coronavirus, concern, of course, about loved ones contracting the virus. Then there's how to cope with all this isolation, this social distancing that comes with this pandemic. Can poetry help? Well, let's see. Crystal Stone joins me now. She's a poet, also a recent graduate of Iowa State University's MFA program in Creative Writing and Environment. Crystal, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, welcome to our program, and I understand you graduated from Iowa State just this week. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me here.
Well, let's start off. I want to get the sort of how you create these poems, but before that, do you have a poem related to the pandemic about isolation or social distancing that you can share right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was writing them in different intervals, pretty much when I had inspiration. So this one is Pandemic Isolation Day 6. Driving past the graffitied rocks on the highway back, I think about the boy yelling on his scooter as he bounced down the path. It's not smooth. It's not smooth. You told me it would be smooth. But no one lied to me. It's been mostly silent at home. On my walk, even the birds in the woods pause, beaks closed to mating calls. The mossy eyes of the rocks glove shut. Swans bathe noiselessly in the mist. On the ground, paprika and pine needles and cayenne leaves, I noticed two tombstones, one buried by a tree, engraved but illegible, the second bitten down, tangled in the tree's roots. Did the dead bodies silently instruct the tree to grow? I grab onto a rope, walk over a bridge made only of small branches, partial plywood planks gathered like a beaver's dam. I soak my feet in muddy puddles, unbalanced, unprepared for the walk, the way everything changes. Another uprooted tombstone interrupts the end of my walk, but this time completely legible, seemingly new. How close are we all to our fears? The life we've been avoiding for years in less than a week, everything transformed on the edge, a singular stranded stone.
Mm. Oh, Crystal, you've captured so much in that poem. Such imagery. I love it. I wonder, did this pandemic immediately present itself to you as a poet, as a rich source of inspiration?
Well, absolutely. But I'm a kind of person that's always looking for a poem. My friends tease me. I have like 4 books in progress at any one given time. And so the poems that I had been writing right before the pandemic, I had written one about attending the Iowa caucus. I had written one about going to jury duty. And so this kind of felt like a natural transition into discussing the sort of like unglamorousness of civic duties. And
right.
So I just kind of tried to capture different lines from my walks outside, observations of people, news articles, things people were sharing on social media, comments that seemed unusual or something that might not have happened if it weren't for the pandemic.
Right. So many of us would love to write poetry as telling, as you do, as beautiful as you do. What is your approach? So you took a walk. We saw all those images, and when we heard your poem there, you have a little book or on your maybe your cell phone. You collect images and then write it later, or does it all come back to you when you're someplace where you can sit and type?
Yeah, I always take notes. So yeah, usually in my phone, I take little notes of different images that I saw. And then at a later point when I'm by myself and it's quiet in my room with my computer, I type it out. And then it doesn't stop there. You know, poems are always in progress. So I have a couple of really close friends I send poems to, and they help me edit them and refine them over weeks, months, sometimes years.
Mm. We have a couple more minutes. We'd love to hear another one of your poems. Do you have one ready?
Yeah, of course. This one is Pandemic Isolation, Day 14. When a job rejects me kindly, my friend says reading the email is like eating flowers. Good, but not good enough. I'm walking alone, trying to enjoy the floral taste of sunlight, the sparkling scent of bay, the windy touch of grass, rocky breath of sand. A man walks by the stone I rest on and sits 20 feet further on the hill on top of his skateboard. I am a stranger in my own country. I no longer know how to navigate the basics, laundry, shopping, cooking, teaching. The virus is author and translator of two tongues I've never learned. The park has a warning that has nothing to do with corona. Enter at your own risk. Coyotes. I've never seen one, just turkeys fighting the car that tries to park. It fans its feathers, gobbles blues.
Oh, I love the line in that poem, I am a stranger in my own country. We all feel that way, don't we, Crystal? We don't
Absolutely.
Recognize our streets. We don't recognize going out of the house. We don't recognize the people we're shopping with. We've all got masks on, don't we? Many of
yeah.
us.
Yeah. Well, and I had isolated with a friend in Boston for the first half of the pandemic, and they didn't have washer or dryer, so we were literally hand washing our clothes in the bathtub. It was taking hours. So.
Oh, well, now there's some imagery for a poem.
Yeah, for sure.
Before we say goodbye, I wonder, tell me a little bit about how these poems, I started off by saying, can poems help? Help with our anxiety, our feelings of isolation. How does it help you?
I think that when I write poems, I'm sort of discovering. So I'm anxious, I'm reflective, just like everyone else is right now. And writing these poems kind of helps me put my thoughts together, captures the moment, helps other people empathize with me. And when I read others' words, helps me understand my own emotions better too. So the constant like writing and exchange of poetry with people in my community, I find healing.
Mm-hmm. And I know you gave a TEDx talk at ISU titled The Transformative Power of Poetry. How have you been transformed by poetry?
You know, in so many ways. But I think that the primary way that I think that poetry transforms us is by allowing us to better understand our own emotions and other people's emotions as we're constantly working through the images that we see in our lives, the things that we've heard in these short moments, these short poems.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, you graduated from ISU just this week. What's next for you?
Well, I'll be attending University of Southern Mississippi for my PhD in creative writing. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty exciting. And hopefully then I'll eventually become a poetry professor.
Uh-huh. And you're publishing books of poems?
Yes. My first book, Knock Off Monarch, came out from Don Valley Press in 2018. And my second book of poetry, All the Places I Wish I Died, is coming out from Clash Books next summer.
Mm-hmm. And do you think the poetry will keep on? I mean, you know, songwriters have, and writers in general just have blanks, or there's a blank page and they can't fill it. Has that ever happened to you?
Oh, yeah. I actually taught algebra before I came to the MFA program, so I didn't write poetry for 2 years. And then one day I just started picking up poetry books again. I read a poetry book each week, and slowly the words came back to me, and I haven't been able to stop since. So I'm sure there will be a drought again, but at least now it's all okay. Right.
Well, we hope it lasts a long time for your benefit and for our benefit, hearing your poems. Crystal Stone, poet, recent graduate of Iowa State University, thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, we've come to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Oh, time to groove into the weekend. There's something that can shape us, that can change us, that can help us through this pandemic. Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio Studio One, right?
Yes, absolutely. Let's
what
get
do you
to
got?
It.
Let's
All
get
right.
to it.
So one of the more fascinating artists out there right now, he goes by the name Thundercat. He is a multi-instrumentalist and producer who's worked with a wide variety of musicians, heavy metal bands, and R&B singers alike, won a Grammy for his work with the rapper Kendrick Lamar, and he also puts out some great solo records, seriously funky and seriously weird music. Thundercat is my kind of guy. His new album is called It Is What It Is, and this is Black Qualls.
Thundercat, Black Qualls, Tony Daner, I love that. I love the mix of voices, different voices yeah. there featured by Thundercat. What do you want to take us out with?
A band from Los Angeles called The Butter Tones, and they also include a lot of different sounds and influences in their music. And the really cool thing about this song we're going to hear is you can hear a lot of those different sounds in just the first few seconds of this song off of their new album. This is The Butter Tones and Phantom Eyes.
Loving that guitar, especially, Tony. Is that sort of a retro-sounding guitar that he's... Would that be the title, the name you'd give that guitar?
Yeah, you know, kind of. It kind of sounds like maybe a Fender Jazzmaster or something like that. But yeah, it goes so effortlessly from that surf rock sound into like suddenly we're in 80s new wave, and it totally right. works. Yeah,
okay,
I can't get enough of that one.
Love it. Thank you very much for grooving us into the weekend, Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio Studio One. Get your daily soundtrack. It's great to relax, to get excited about, get away from this pandemic and all the news. Tony, thanks for grooving us into the weekend.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Stay well, stay safe. We'll talk to you again next week.
determined no one will have you.